Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd be stricken with nephromegaly if I had to pass the idea that you missed today's show. It's actually nephromegaly. Get to the next level. Lawrence Pagnoni is author of The Nonprofit Fundraising Solution. Based on his work as an executive director and fundraising consultant, he has proven strategies to get you to the next level of fundraising revenue. This originally aired on November 8th, 2013. I wish he would pronounce his name Pagnoni, Lorenzo Pagnoni. On Tony's Take Two, video from Venice, we're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven and technology-enabled. You'll raise more money, Pursuant.com. Let's go with our first segment. Here is Lawrence Pagnoni. I'm very pleased that Lawrence Pagnoni's book and his work bring him to the studio. He has spent 25 years in the nonprofit sector and was an executive director of three nonprofits. He's been a faculty member at the NYU Hyman Center for Philanthropy and Fundraising. We've had guests from there. And he coaches a group of executive directors with the Rutgers Business School's Institute for Ethical Leadership. His book is The Nonprofit Fundraising Solution, Powerful Revenue Strategies to Take You to the Next Level. Lawrence Pagnoni, welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to have you. I love having live in-studio guests. It just makes it that much more special. Congratulations on the book. It's out this month, right?
Yes, just a few weeks ago, and delighted it has robust sales so far.
Excellent. Very good for you.
Thanks.
Very good. I have to ask you this. I've wondered about this since I first saw your name, which is years. Why isn't it Pagnoni? Why Pagnoni? How did you... I'm not Martignetti. Why did you... Somewhere along the lineage, you went to Pagnoni. How'd that happen?
It's my grandmother would like your question. It's Lorenzo Antonio Pagnoni.
That's beautiful.
So you're it's like a little Verdi opera, right? expression of it is accurate, but you know, in the American vernacular, it gets Pagnoni.
I hate that. Your grandmother would love the Pagnoni. That was a beautiful name. It is
exactly
operatic. The nonprofit fundraising solution. What is the problem?
Well, undercapitalization of the sector plagues more than 77% of nonprofits. They have a vision, but they don't have the money to implement it. And many organizations spend years on a plateau under $250,000 trying to execute their vision. Now, for some small nonprofits, a humble budget is more than adequate, and they're doing good services, and they are meeting their vision. So I don't mean to imply that you need money to do your work. Mm-hmm. There are amazing volunteer organizations. But for those organizations that need money, I wrote the book in that spirit of trying to help them to go to the next level.
Which is such a ubiquitous question. I mean, I get that a lot. And I work only really in the planned giving and the charity registration niches. But even I am asked a lot, you know, how do we get to the next level? Can you help us get to the next level? Right. So there are a lot of organizations that do want to go to increased fundraising revenue.
It's the number one question I get when I give seminars or public trainings, and somebody inevitably will wander up to that mic, as I say in the introduction, and ask me, how do you get to the next level? And on the one hand, it's a poetic question, but on the other hand, it's... For my sensibilities, it's a business question with mathematical methods behind it. And the book tries to explain that if you get your leadership understanding the vision for what the next level looks like, if the board supports that vision, if you think about higher level strategies and you work on changing the culture of your organization so that the organizational development matches that vision, that's the foundation. Those four aspects are the foundation for going to the next level. And then the rest is tactical. Most fundraising is tactical. The strategy comes from the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to have time to talk about the organizational development as well as the strategies and tactics. Right. I love that we have the full hour together.
Thanks.
So the symptoms of this problem are, I mean, sort of event-to-event fundraising or maybe sole source revenue streams?
Yeah, most foundation grants have a three-year limit. There are some exceptions to that, of course, places like the Robin Hood Foundation, which see themselves as long-term partners. But event-to-event without any cash reserves. Mm. And some organizations just go year to year like that and make do. And with a little bit of luck and providence, they squeak by. But it's hard to plan having an impact on your mission and on the sector, the field of service, if you will, that you've chosen. If you really want to help at-risk kids have a better chance at getting into college or getting the right on the right employment.
That's a great example because it's for year. You do have to plan for years. That's a life cycle of a child. And if you're, you know, as you say, just getting by year to year, how can you plan for that child's future? You can't plan for your own.
That's right.
Do you think that since we see such a reliance on events, I have a theory, I don't know, but you're free to disagree, that the reliance on events is so that people can avoid what they fear, which is having to sit across the table from someone and look them in the eye and ask them for a gift.
Mm. Well, it's funny, as best as I understand it, and I'm always learning, events were, the history of them goes back to having an opportunity to thank your individual donors. They weren't actually fundraisers unto themselves, and then they, of course, morphed into that. When in fundraising, when the event is linked to individual giving and get into the individual giving program, they always raise more money. Because the point is that the 20% of your individual donor base who gives 80% generally on your revenue,
yeah.
Since the recession, we see it's maybe 70-30. They need to be talked to individually and thoughtfully. And having tough conversations with donors is part of that territory. And I think a lot of people are shy about that. Money, of course, is one of the great taboos of life. Mm. And so it's fraught with emotional issues.
You allude to some research done by Stanford about the dominant revenue source. Flesh that out for us.
Sure. Well, you often hear people say that they need a diversified revenue base.
Yes.
And I've heard that for years. As a fundraiser and as a former executive director, I used to worry about how much time and energy that took to have more than one or two revenue streams. So a few years ago, Stanford University did research on 140, 141 nonprofits that had gotten over the $50 million mark annual budget. And what they discovered was a surprise, that those organizations generally had a dominant source of revenue and possibly a secondary source of revenue. Mm. And wasn't as diversified as smaller nonprofits. But they also said that smaller nonprofits still needed to diversify until they got to that plateau got to that level when they could break through for a dominant source of revenue. And the reason this is interesting is that those nonprofits that got over $50 million, they knew everything there was to know about that dominant source of revenue. If it was individual giving, say, for example, Habitat for Humanity, their dominant source of revenue is individual giving, followed by in-kind donations, followed by foundations. They knew everything there was about individual giving from their first acquisition to planned giving and the whole continuum within those two ends.
Yes. We are going to take a break, and then we'll of course continue with Lawrence, and we'll talk a little more about the inflexibility that we're talking about now, and that sort of tradition of dominant source giving. But then we're going to move on, and we're going to talk about what it takes for the organization to develop within before it can get to the next level. So hang in there.
Sure. You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick, 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals archive at TonyMartinetti.com. That's MartinetiNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. Lawrence Pagnoni is with me. He's the author of The Nonprofit Fundraising Solution. So before the break, we were talking a little about this dominant source. So they knew their dominant source and maybe a secondary source very well. So it's not so bad to be focused that way?
No. It turns out that there are different levels in every revenue source. From an average level to quite skilled level. What they had to have, of course, in their dominant source of revenue was they had to have deep and abiding expertise, low staff turnover amongst the fundraising staff was very important for those organizations because the institutional memory of with their donors had to be preserved. It's called development for a reason. It's a developmental process. So if you're walking the walk with a donor through their lifetime of giving, if they get comfortable with a fundraiser, the chances of that fundraiser being able to raise more money are much higher. Now, of course, that's juxtaposed to the Chronicle and Philanthropy's article this past year, which showed that the dissatisfaction amongst fundraisers with their organizations was extremely high.
Yes.
And we
talked about that on the show.
Did you?
Yeah.
I was distraught to hear that. And because fundraising is a noble profession, and when it's not respected, the process is not respected, then people expect returns too fast, or they expect the fundraiser to come in with donors ready to go without having to cultivate them for your mission. And these very irrational ideas dominate the conversations around fundraising. But it's called development for a reason. And those nonprofits that got above $50 million that had a dominant source, they had a patience to their culture. And they respected the cultivation process. And they closed, you know, on major gifts much more frequently than those that didn't have that culture.
What was the first organization that you were executive director of?
Oh, my. It was a soup kitchen for the homeless in Richmond, Virginia.
And I'm guessing there were a lot of lessons you learned there.
Oh, my goodness. In the book, I tell the story of how I forgot about the board. Now, I didn't technically forget about the board. I attended board meetings. I prepared my reports. I had the board book ready and met with the committees when they needed me.
Mm-hmm.
But in my soul, they were superfluous. And what was really important was getting the program metrics right and getting the fundraising going. But I came to see how the board, in my second executive directorship here in New York at Harlem United, I came to see how the board can give the organization a gift that the CEO cannot, which is the gift of longevity and survivability and that great word that we use in the sector, sustainability.
So in your experience in, was it West Virginia, you said?
Richmond, Virginia.
In Virginia at the soup kitchen. Were you sort of dragging the board along as you worked on the metrics that were important to you, or
kicking them was more
kicking
my
from
style.
Behind or pulling, oh, okay, so kicking from behind.
Well, that was the Italian way, right?
Yeah,
more like a bull in a china shop. But the urgency was, of course, that homelessness was extremely bad. The single room occupancy hotels in Richmond, Virginia, were closing at a rapid rate, and the homeless shelters were increasing. So we had a profound sense of urgency. And then right in the middle of that, the AIDS epidemic was becoming clearer to us. And so there was this sense of urgency. And we, in fact, founded three different organizations as spinoffs to our nonprofit. But I came to see the value of board leadership and board endorsement and to recruit people that did add value. Not everybody is meant to be a board member, and I had made the mistake of just recruiting volunteers that had a passion for the board without necessarily having the business talents and skills that I needed to fulfill the mission that we were aimed at over 10 to 20 years.
And we're going to talk later on about one of the opportunities that you've identified, leadership councils, for maybe the type of people that you're talking about, not suitable for the board, but have interest and passion, and so there may be another role for them.
Yes.
So let's talk about the board now. The board has to, it's essential that the board be developed before the organization is going to get to the next level.
Oh, yes. A lot of CEOs inherit a board when they take a job that isn't necessarily up for the task, and they wait on the sidelines for something magical to happen with that board. And they don't necessarily see themselves as an intervening variable to bring the board to the next level themselves. But I recommend in my book that they do see themselves as part of the change process for the board by meeting personally with board members, by recruiting people who have the skills and talents that they'd be delighted to have in leaders. Mm-hmm. And that's not all, they're not always easy processes. They take time. But
you're trying to develop a shared vision on the board.
Exactly.
Between the executive leadership and the CEO or executive director and the volunteer leadership.
That's right.
This can take a long time to align a vision.
It can. But there are plenty of examples where it happens rather fast. I mean, the board.
Oh, share one.
The board in Richmond, Virginia, the board of Harlem United here in New York. Mm-hmm. They were united around being thought leaders in the field of innovative healthcare for people who fell outside the healthcare system, the homeless and indigent. And saw their revenue streams from the government, both federal and state, as needing to be reformed so that they could get the funds that were needed. For example, in 1991, there were no Article 28 healthcare, primary care clinics for people living with AIDS. They were only the purveyors of mental health. So what the board did with the executive staff's leadership is they formed a statewide organization called the Adult Day Healthcare Coalition, and they changed the way the revenue stream was structured so that Article 28 could include primary care for people living with AIDS.
Article 28 is a federal?
State.
New York State.
State health, so that you could receive third-party Medicare reimbursement.
Okay.
It's an amazing revenue stream, extremely stable, and it helped keep people out of hospital emergency rooms so you could provide care at a much lower rate. So sometimes revenue streams have that level of complexity to them, and you need a board that could understand the thinking behind that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes revenue streams are easier to understand. I mean, I think that's why people often gravitate to foundation grants. They can look at a foundation's website, they can understand the application process, and they throw their their hat in the ring to see if they're going to be, you know, lucky.
Let's focus on, again, the achieving this shared vision across the board. So it certainly takes place in board recruitment, board meetings, I mean, month after month. I mean, what's the executive director's role in trying to align the board with this with a common vision?
Well, one of my great teachers, Carl Mathiasen, who was an expert in board development, he used to say that a board will talk about anything, and then he'd pause and he'd say, if you let them.
Okay.
So the point was that the executive director, in private dialogue with the board chair or the executive committee, had to understand how to create an agenda that was consistent with where they were headed so that the organization didn't waste a lot of time.
Yes. Okay.
Oftentimes, you know, can you imagine, Tony, in an average year, how many board meetings I sit in and listen? And so much of what boards talk about is inconsequential to their deepest desires and goals.
Paperclips and office supplies as one example.
Yeah.
You know, Okay.
And, you know, on the worst end, the executive director doesn't want to be micromanaged. You know, you hear that language a lot. And, of course, on the other hand, the executive director is under macromanaging.
Yeah.
And the opposite, of course, of micromanagement is macromanagement. And macromanagement is about the strategic alliance of the vision. And here's where you see a lot of executive directors check out, and it leaves them vulnerable to being micromanaged. So I encourage in the book for the culture of a board to be robust, and that the CEO see him or herself as part of a shaper or a leader in that. Now, a lot of nonprofit CEOs will read that and they would go, well, duh, you know, I've been doing that for years. But when you look across the sector, that's not necessarily the habit of many CEOs. They often see themselves as just employees of the board,
and they abdicate that board leadership responsibility.
Yes,
even though they're not the named chair of the board, but you're advocating that they still have a strong role in board leadership.
That's right. Yeah. And some CEOs who were former program directors, and then they became the CEO, they're not, by their character, change agents. So what I'm describing is a character of a CEO that's really a change agent, because I'm interested in high-performing nonprofits that solve the social problem that they set out to solve, whether it be reducing teen pregnancies or having more kids get through the school system successfully, or adult employment, for example. So those CEOs of those kinds of organizations generally are change agents. And it's not to say there's something bad about the CEOs that are not. It's just that I think that they have to think about a different place in the sector that might be better suited for their skills and talents.
Okay. Let's talk briefly about the gift of significance that you recommend from board members. Now, you in the book, you have a calculation for what that ought to be, board member to board member, and we don't really have a chance to go through that calculation. But why not a significant gift? Why is it a gift of significance?
Well, that's a significant point. Most boards think about board trustee giving as give or get. And then there's a third part of that that's unsaid, which is give, get, or...
Yeah, get off.
Get off. Right. So I never liked that. And I taught at the United Way here in New York City for many years. I taught their board seminar and did the give and get policies. And there's wisdom to that. And I'm not opposed to give and get policies. But I think there's a much more thoughtful way to engage the process, which is to have a conversation about a gift of significance. What for you, when you look at your philanthropic giving in the past few years, given your current income, what is a significant gift that stands out amongst all your giving? And the reason that this is a particularly good approach for a trustee is that a trustee is stepping up in a leadership capacity to inspire other donors to give by their giving. And they have to see the connection between how they think about their giving and what they want the donors of the organization to do, because the development director or the vice president of institutional advancement or the CEO needs to say, my trustees have stepped up. They've made leadership gifts.
100%.
They cumulatively give, $26,753. I'm that precise when I calculate the cumulative giving of a board and report it back to donors. And the donors often laugh, but I'd rather give them the real numbers to know that this is a real process. If your trustees on your board that can't give a gift of significance, that's not true. Everybody can give a gift of significance. I mean,
it's what's significant to them.
Exactly. Consumers of services, that social work term, consumers or program members, on the boards that I've worked at, and I've used the same principle with them. It could be $5, could be $50,
yes,
but for them, it's a significant gift. And in phrasing it that way as a gift of significance, it captures the energy that we're looking for around thinking about being a fundraising leader. And, of course, ideally, too, from time to time, you want to ask the board to stretch beyond their normal giving, which is when you're in a campaign or a special drive or there's an anniversary, things like that. Mm-hmm. So,
continuing with some of the strategies that you recommend, you like parlor gatherings.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
What's a parlor gathering?
Could be in an office conference room, could be in your living room. Parties with a purpose is the general phrase. And the purpose is the benevolence that the party, it's not a party for a party's sake, it's a party for a purpose. And the purpose is to sponsor and endorse and give money to the charity that is the primary focus. There are 90-minute gatherings. I describe the actual methods and rollout. It's mm-hmm. very user-friendly chapter. But a lot of organizations keep waiting for that moment when they're going to go to the next level. And fundraising, of course, is a practitioner's art. So here in the parties with a purpose, you see a very practical method that you could roll out in 2 to 3 months, 60 to 90 days. In fact, one of the smaller nonprofits that listens to your radio program read the book, their whole development committee. They're all volunteers.
Well, I love them because they're listening.
Yes.
I don't care what they do fundraising-wise. Frankly, Lawrence, I don't care if they bought your book or not. They're listening to the show. You can stop there. I love them. Whoever you are, we love you. You know who you are. We love you. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's true. And they are going to do a party. When they called, I said, I'll give you a free, as I do anybody, I'll give anybody a free 40-minute phone conversation about questions they have about the book. Or I also come into organizations to meet with a development team or a board team. Anyway, so I gave them a free consultation, and they wanted to do a party with a purpose in the future. And I said, oh, no, we're going to have it before the year ends.
Now, we're doing it now.
And
we're,
they're going to be doing it right after, between Christmas and New Year's.
Excellent.
Excellent indeed. Love, Lawrence Pagnoni. This is... This is a very, very good show. You should get this book. If you don't have it, Nonprofit Fundraising Solution, you ought to. Tony's Take Two and more with Lawrence coming up. First, I'm going to chat about Pursuant, because they have a tool called Billboard, and it helps you manage your communications. Naturally, you are multi-channel. Email, landing pages, microsites, donation forms, etc., the social networks. Don't separate those. Integrate. I thought of that myself. I think I might have, you know, it's been a few weeks since I've been in the studio because I was away. But I believe I said that a couple weeks ago. Don't separate. Integrate. Because Billboard is integrated communications management. Puts all these tools and all these channels together into one management tool. And not only management, but also analytics, so that you know which of your channels are most effective, because after, well, depending on how many campaigns you do and how engaged you are, might be after 3 months you want to look back. But if not, if you're not that prolific, maybe after a year or so, you want to look back and see what's been the most effective. The analytics will answer that. Then you fine tune and you improve and you raise more money or get more volunteers or have more successful events. Whatever it is you're engaging for, you'll do it better with the unified, integrated management and the analytics that go with Billboard. So if you want to improve your engagement, your outreach, check out Billboard at Pursuant.com. Really, Pursuant is a perfect sponsor for small and mid-sized nonprofits. Our listeners, obviously, say it all the time. Because they have these tools that you can use separately online, or you know you can choose a larger suite of tools together, or at the highest level, they actually do on-site, you know, campaign consulting, live bodies helping you manage your campaign. So, but you don't have to go that far. So I just think they're perfect, you know, sort of a la carte. And I love the CEO, Trent Ricker, has a background in nonprofits and recognizes the challenges that small and mid-sized shops are facing around fundraising and engagement. Pursuant.com. I've got video from Venice, Venezia. I was there last week. Oh my goodness. In fact, exactly this time last week. There are gondoliers in the background. So you got to check that out. And I'm talking about how you keep your planned giving above water. You do it by cultivating and soliciting the right prospects. The video with the gondoliers is at TonyMartinetti.com. And that is Tony's Take Two for Friday, 2nd of October, 39th show of the year. Let's get back to Lorenzo Pagnoni.
Let's talk more about parlor gatherings, Lawrence. It is a very, as you said, user-friendly chapter. You have a lot of very robust advice. And I've always liked the idea of small, intimate gatherings. So we're going to focus on my prejudice for these types of events, not to the exclusion. Well, here on the show, we don't have a chance to talk about all the strategies that you have in the book, but the book is full of lots of fundraising strategies. I happen to like I never heard them called parlor gatherings, but I like that idea. Who should host these parlor gatherings?
Generally, there's one host who has a good network of friends, work colleagues, family members, and can turn out 25 to 30 people. I've been at parties with a purpose, parlor gatherings that have as many as 75.
That's a big parlor.
Yeah. Okay. But they have, you know, they're people with big names and they have big networks. And
so mostly the host is responsible for inviting the guests?
Mostly the host. Now, in some organizations where a host doesn't feel that they can deliver 25 to 30 people, maybe they have a co-host, or I've done three hosts, and each of them commit to delivering, you know, 10 people. Mm-hmm. And that's worked very well, especially because they've had the support and partnership of two other people that they like, and they're going to do it together, and they see it as a fun thing to do. I love the fact that most of the expense budgets on parlor gatherings are a couple hundred dollars. We don't put out a lot of fancy food. We use cheap wine or no wine at all, depending on the organization. That always has to be thought through. And we don't spend money on trinkets or literature. If the host wants paper invitations as opposed to just using a electronic invitation service like Ping, the host then has to pay for the cost of that, not the organization. And and as I said, they are usually planned in 60 to 90 days.
Yeah. Okay. And you want nobody to talk for more than 5 minutes.
That's right.
Who should talk?
Well, it has to be somebody that that people can emotionally connect with, generally a client or a consumer who is prepared to deliver and is comfortable talking to a group.
Those can be very tender, intimate moments,
yes.
Right? When it's someone who's benefiting from the services of the organization.
That's right.
I've seen tears in colleges, scholarship recipients, but the causes, some of the causes you mentioned, run much more deeply even than education.
Yeah, people who have healed from years of recovery, people who have been supported in their process of coming out of jails or prisons, people who have been through adoption processes. I mean, their stories are extremely powerful, and telling a story is what you need to help them work on and prepare for, so that they have some flair and some theatrics to it, where the audience makes eye contact with them, and that they have good hand gestures, and that they're articulate. And everybody, of course, has their own style. I've been to some parties with a purpose where the clients are very sotto voce, and they have a quiet manner, but nonetheless...
Your grandmother would appreciate yes. you slipping a little Italian
little
in.
Italian in there very for good. Our Italian listeners.
Yes.
They're quieter in their presentation, but nonetheless still powerful because they prepared.
Still very moving.
Very moving.
Yeah.
Video is often good at larger events, but in smaller events, the intimacy of a smaller room gives good stage to personal witness.
Who else should be talking?
Well, some official from the organization, a board member or a volunteer or a staff member.
CEO? Doesn't have to be the CEO?
No, no.
Oh,
the CEO okay. is more than happy, more than welcome to think of him or herself. But again, in a high-functioning fundraising culture, everybody should be empowered to talk about the money and to talk about the money in a way that other people get it. And doesn't have to be the CEO.
Okay.
One of the stories I tell in the book is a first party with a purpose for a small agency in Brooklyn, a substance abuse recovery agency. They never did any private fundraising. They had always relied on government grants. And their first time out, they raised $26,000, $27,000. They had two clients tell their story, and a board member who never saw herself as a fundraiser stood up and was crying after listening to the two consumers tell their story. And she burst out with a $5,000 pledge, and somebody else in the room matched it. And none of that was prepared, but it was prepared conceptually, because we do have a bias in who we invite, that we try to invite people that we know something about, that they have some means. Now, we're not strict about that, but we do ask the question and do seek people who have that some level of affluence. Now, a lot of smaller nonprofits say right off the bat, I don't know anybody, you know, with that level of affluence. And I say, okay, well, let's work with what we have. But amazingly, they always find somebody who writes that 80% of the room's check.
All right. Rehearsing. You like to rehearse these.
Rehearsing is very important. You know, the penultimate example is Steve Jobs before he passed away at Apple. His launches of new products were legendary, right? He practiced those for weeks, 6-7 weeks every single day, running the whole team through rehearsals and himself. And anything worth doing is worth practicing for and preparing well for. So don't think you could just like call the client up the night before and say, would you speak tomorrow at our, you know, party with a purpose? That's not the way to do it.
And what about the important follow-up to your parlor gatherings?
Well, part of the second speaker or the third speaker's role is to ask for funds, and a pledge form is handed out, and some people fill it out right there, and it's collected as people leave. And for those that don't hand the pledge form in, follow-up is necessary. First of all, follow-up is necessary for everybody to say thank you. We have a rule of sending out our thank you notes in 48 hours, business hours, which a lot of nonprofits find, you know, really a high rule to meet. But we think it's important that people get both paper and email thank yous, and they get a cumulative understanding of what happened at the party, because a lot of donors are going to leave and they're not going to know the cumulative results that they participated in, that 26 or 27,000 or 5,000 or 2,500 was raised.
And you want to share that impact.
You want to share that impact, and you want to let people feel the good vibes of that they participated in that. They made it happen. And so the thank you notes need to go out. The results need to go out by both email and paper. And then, of course, the giving history needs to be recorded in your database. And there's no excuse for a nonprofit, whether they're volunteer with no budget, not having a database. As I say in the book, you can go to ebase.org, get a free database that was developed by the Rockefeller Family Foundation. At my website for the book, the nonprofitfundraisingsolution.com, there's links to free databases. Or you could just use a good Excel spreadsheet and stay organized, or an Access database that comes with your, you know, your computer. There's no excuse these days for, you don't have to spend, you know, $10,000 a month with Razor's Edge or something.
Thank you for sharing those resources too.
Sure.
Leadership councils. We alluded to these earlier. What's the role of a leadership council?
Well, a nonprofit has a board that worries about its governance. Generally, we say that the executive staff is supposed to be worried about 1 to 3 years of management, and the board should be thinking about 5 to 10 years. The Pentagon, of course, has a 75-year strategic plan, so they know where they're going to be. I would like our sector to know a lot more about where it's going to be. Mm. But no matter how powerful your board is, you still need more community endorsement for your organization. And a leadership council gives you that. It's a non-governance structure. Some people call it honorary councils or advisory councils. I like the term leadership council because it's what we're looking for. We're looking for them to be leaders. And sometimes those leaders can step up and say things that your board can't say or your executive staff can't say about your cause. And as we saw last year or 2 years ago with Planned Parenthood, there were many people on its leadership council who spoke up in their defense where their board needed to keep a quieter voice. So leadership councils are very important. And sometimes you put people on leadership councils who don't want to do the heavy lifting of governance. And sometimes you put them on because you have good feelings about how they love your organization and you want to maintain that relationship, but they're not appropriate for the board. So it's a mix of characters.
We're going to take a break for a couple of minutes. We'll keep talking about leadership councils.
And I'm going to do live listener love. I got to start with where I'm going to be next week. Mexico City, Mexico. Welcome. Hola, ¿qué tal? I'm going to be there next week for Opportunity Collaboration, which used to be a sponsor of the show, actually staying over just overnight in Mexico City and then flying the next day to Ixtapa, where the Opportunity Collaboration Unconference is going to be. New York, New York, live listener love to you. Also to St. Louis, Missouri, Brooklyn, New York, and Wilmington, North Carolina. Live listener love to each location, each person. Forget the location. The love goes to the person, not to their office or their building or their block. It's to you, heart to heart, live listener love. Beijing is frequent listening. Beijing, thank you very much. Ni hao. And Seoul, South Korea, also so grateful for the loyalty coming from Seoul. Anyo hasayo. Affiliate affections to our many affiliate listeners throughout the country at our AM and FM affiliate stations. And we're going to have some new ones to announce. Give me a couple weeks. We got some announcements coming up. But in the meantime, everybody who's listening now from all our AM and FM stations, affections out to you. And of course, the all-important podcast pleasantries for the over 10,000 people we know who listen on whatever device, at whatever time, doing whatever activity, podcast pleasantries to you. Let's take a break, and then we'll go right back into Lawrence Pagnoni.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag Nonprofit Radio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office. Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
What is our leadership council going to do?
Lead, endorse for legitimacy, credibility. They're there to say, we like these guys, what they're doing, we endorse. And there's power by that association with their name. And they don't even have to do anything just to have that happen. We do want people to do things on the Leadership Council. They're generally a couple things. We want them to come to an annual gathering of the Leadership Council so that they could get their own personal update about the organization. Secondly, we want them to meet with us individually, us being the development office or the executive office. We want to meet with them individually to talk about their own gift to the organization, plus their network of possibly doing, guess what, a party with a purpose for their network. So there's a lot of integration of the tactics in part two of the book, while part one is all about the way you think about fundraising. Part two is all about the intermarriage of various tactics. For example, in a leadership council, I think I mentioned this in the planned giving chapter, you could have a leadership council just for the people who are part of your planned giving
program.
Note that
there is a chapter devoted to planned giving.
Very important.
That's the only reason Lawrence is here, even though we're not talking about that chapter. But it's the only thing that drew me to the book. I read it from backward. I read that chapter first.
The planned giving is many times nonprofits overlook having a planned giving society for the donors that give through their bequests or their wills or insurance policies or whatever the mechanism. And having a leadership council of your planned giving group is very important. There was a small a client I worked with here in East Haven, Connecticut, the Shoreline Trolley Museum. They're in the midst of closing on a $2 million campaign so that they could have proper buildings for their antique trolleys. They have 100 antique trolleys, which tell the story of the trolleys from the 1800s. It's an amazing place. My kids love it. And they never had paid attention to their legacy, their planned giving donors. And we started to talk to them more and organize that group. And they have a leadership council now of their planned giving donors.
Oh.
And 21 people joined the first year, and I think 4 or 5 have joined the second year. And they were unsung people who had thought about giving for the future, where I think you would know better than I, but something like a low 7% of people think about a planned gift, whereas in their course of their life, like 85 or 90% of people think about giving But upon their death, they generally just leave their money to their family.
Yeah, there's some small percentage of people that have a charitable bequest in their will.
Yes.
When the Leadership Council is advocating and endorsing, who are they advocating and endorsing to?
To the press, to other thought leaders, at conferences. During the height of the AIDS epidemic, the Leadership Council that I put together at Harlem United, many of those leaders would mention in their addresses about AIDS and how to compassionately respond, they would mention that they were on the Honorary Council of Harlem United. It meant legitimacy for them and for us that they would mention that. It worked both ways.
You had a leadership council, you cite in the book, that had 55 members.
Oh, yes.
That sounds huge.
Yes. And I had the same response to the CEO, and he turned around and said, but look at my mission. I have to represent, you know, this whole county. And there were, I don't know, 24 or 5 smaller towns in this county. And he represented 3 sectors, not just the nonprofit sector, but government and business. And real estate was a big factor of that. So he needed a large council, and he saw the wisdom of that. And he actually had a staff member hired to manage that leadership council. And it brought him, it was a wise move. It brought him a lot of impact because he didn't neglect his leadership council. A lot of times leadership councils are started. Mm-hmm. I go in and I'm auditing an organization and I look at their letterhead and I say, oh, you have an advisory council. It says here, oh, well, yeah, but not really, Lawrence. I said, what do you mean? Well, we really don't, you know, that was a couple years ago and it was so-and-so's idea and it's just fallen by the wayside. You see, there's an example where the culture of the organization didn't embrace the tactic. Tactics don't raise money.
Yeah, excellent.
On their own, they need a culture to nest in. And if the tactic is in an organization where it's loved and cared for, it then produces results. So then they get your crazy idea that, oh, well, the Leadership Council never really did raise much money for us, totally disassociating themselves from lack of developing it and creating a plan for it. Mm-hmm. At Harlem United, our Leadership Council was reviewed every year, and the plan was updated and revised and evaluated, and that was brought to the board member, at a board meeting. We always had co-chairs for the Leadership Council, male and female. I'm pretty consistent about that for capital campaigns, male and female leaders of the campaign cabinet. And those two leaders I would invite to come in and give a state of the union of our Leadership Council to the board. And the board members would go to the annual gathering of the Leadership Council. All the board members were asked to do that. And so there was nice synergy and harmony there. No competition.
We have just about a minute and a half before we have to wrap up, and so I want to spend that time asking what it is that you love about the work that you do.
Well, fundraising is a noble profession, and it's a bridge builder between the idea that you have that will make the world a better place and the money you need to actualize the program. And so the methods of fundraising are build that bridge. And
you love building bridges.
And absolutely. One of my old teachers used to say, if you build bridges, don't be surprised when people walk on them or walk over you. But nonetheless, fundraising is that bridge between the nonprofit's idea and the reality of making it happen.
There are lots of very good ideas in the book. It is The Nonprofit Fundraising Solution, Powerful Revenue Strategies to Take You to the Next Level. Lawrence Pagnoni. Lawrence is Laurence Pagnoni.
Perfect.
Thank you so much for being a guest. It's been a pleasure.
I've been delighted to be here. And I want to shout out just quickly to all my blog readers, about 4,500 of them.
Where's your blog?
Nonprofitfundraisingsolution.com, and you can sign up there to be on the blog.
Outstanding. Thank you again.
All right, thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Lorenzo. Some more live listener love. While we were doing it the last time, a couple of countries checked in. India, live listener love to you, and Tokyo. Tokyo, loyal listeners, thank you very, very much. Konnichiwa. If you missed any part of today's show, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. Where in the world else would you go? Next week's show, Claire Meyerhoff is with me for our discussion of your planned giving legacy society. Hint, we don't really like the phrase legacy society. Pursuant, full service fundraising, you'll raise bags more money. I'm not talking about those little quart bags that you put your 3-ounce shampoo in when you fly. I'm talking about duffel bags, like the Marines carry onto those C-130s when they're going overseas, filled with money. Pursuant.com. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is the line producer. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez, SusanChavez.com, and our music is by Scott Stein. Thank you for that affirmation. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick, 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals archive at TonyMartinetti.com. That's MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.